One, two, three. Look up.
Say no, that's hard.
It is hard, but teaching first aid in communities with a lot of gun violence could save lives. I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
I just want to go over the results of your recent hand x-ray.
My job is to care about everything.
The technical term for this is imagery, auditory imagery.
Telling yourself, like, it's going to get better, like, next year will be better.
I like to think that we're all bones from Star Trek.
Yep, that's pain. Yep, it's bad.
Now it's people say, my God, that could be my child.
They never go away. They outlast every other piece of knowledge I've managed to acquire in my life.
They consume all the oxygen in the water.
I felt like I was in a fun form.
There are separate sensors for all of these things.
On today's show, public health to the rescue, interventions that prevent harm and save lives, using technology to connect sick students to doctors right in their elementary school, getting lead out of our homes and out of our bodies, and trying to stop a major killer of women. First up, let's head to Washington. It's October 2015.
So welcome to the White House, and welcome to the Bystander Stop the Bleed Forum.
Stop the Bleed. The title basically explains this initiative, which was introduced by the Department of Homeland Security.
Less than 5 minutes. That's how long it can take for a severely injured person to bleed to death. And we all know through our own experiences that 5 minutes is often just not enough time to get a trained professional to the scene. 5 minutes can make the difference between life and death.
So the White House is pushing for more Americans to be ready to step in and save a person who might otherwise bleed to death. And in a city like Philadelphia, with over 1,000 shootings last year, a program to train citizens looks and sounds a lot like something out of a war zone. Tanya English reports.
It's 6 in the evening. Kids are running around. Their parents and neighbors are gathered in an elementary school cafeteria. There are first aid training stations set up all over the room, and it's time for everyone to rotate.
Oscar!
In the back of the room, ER nurse Edward Bell is teaching direct pressure and elevation.
Pressure point's located on the inside of the arm, and basically you're going to take your hand, get up underneath the inside of the arm, and you're just going to, it's like, clamp it down.
He demonstrates how to stop the blood flow, then a woman from the group tries it.
And you take an old towel, T-shirt, and you just wrap it around as tight as you can until help arrives.
Bell and the other trainers are from Temple University Hospital, and this program was specially designed for communities dealing with gun violence. In North Philadelphia, Temple is the closest emergency room.
I think we do a really great job, but a lot of times we're pulling people out of the back of a police car who have had absolutely no intervention whatsoever.
First aid right at the scene of a stabbing or a shooting can give someone a little more time. But Bell says personal safety comes first.
We don't want anybody going out, quote unquote, when bullets are flying.
So far, more than 100 people have come out to community events like this one in North Philadelphia.
My name is Louise Smith, and everybody call me Miss Midge, and I'm from 12th and Cambridge.
Smith volunteers at the rec center down the street, and in the summer at the big neighborhood block party, she's the lady who sells the flavored water ice.
Even with the kids, if they don't have no money, I just give it to them.
She's lived here for 30 years.
About a year ago, we seen a shooting round here, and it's a shame the two boys died right on the sidewalk. They just, you know, wasn't nobody there to help them, and neighborhoods being tore down. It wasn't just that incident.
When a young African-American man dies in Philadelphia, more than half the time, it's a gun homicide.
It's not because of cancer. It's not because of car accidents. It's not because of house fires. It's because somebody pointed a gun at him and pulled that trigger.
Scott Charles is the trauma outreach coordinator at Temple, and for a decade, he's worked to prevent gun injury. He's waiting for laws to change and the political debate to untangle, but he says bystander first aid is something that can help right now.
We have to put the power in people's hands to address this issue.
Temple University's program is called Fighting Chance. So far, there's no real funding behind it, and all the first aid trainers are volunteers like Nurse Maureen Quigg.
The knee closest to the victim is down, the other knee is up, and that's what you stand up with, the power from your legs and not your back.
Quigg explained how to do a two-person lift and carry.
You crisscross hands in the back, one hand and you grab onto the, either the belt loop or the pants themselves. But your arms are like in an X across his back. You count to three. Keep your head up.
One, two, three. Look up.
Say no, that's hard.
But the smaller women aren't convinced they'll be able to help a 250-pound man lying in the street. But Quigg thinks they could.
If it's someone that you care about or in a situation where there's a lot of activity, your adrenaline's going. You have all this extra energy. You have all this extra power. And if you focus on doing it and doing it the right way, you can lift someone who you would never think you could lift, and you can do it without hurting yourself.
In the middle of the room, another nurse is teaching her group how to tie a tourniquet.
There are 5 gunshots to that leg. You're going to control the bleeding to all 5 of those gunshots. That's really
the topic
important.
Is serious, but the mood
us.
Isn't. 63-year-old Alice Kellum laughs with her neighbors as she moves from one training station to the next.
I know about the tourniquet. I know if you use your string, your hair, your weave, anything to stop the blood. Yep, I know that already.
Kellum has on a camouflage tracksuit and rhinestone hoop earrings. She's chatty. But when she talks about her husband, who was murdered in 1990, she doesn't have a lot to say, except that it was senseless.
They took his sneaks and his hat. That was it.
Kellum wasn't there when her husband was gunned down, but says she's ready to help someone else. And there's evidence that bystanders and witnesses to violence do better psychologically if they take action.
The freeze response is the predictor of worst outcomes.
Psychiatrist Stephen Berkowitz is part of the Violence Prevention Initiative at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.
You know, that deer in the headlights, that rabbit freezing in the street. When human beings do that, that predicts a bad outcome.
He says the closer you are physically or emotionally to a violent incident, the greater the chance that you'll develop post-traumatic stress disorder. Nosheen Hadari is a crisis therapist in Chicago. She cares for children and families in South Lawndale, Humboldt Park, Cicero, and says nearly every one of her clients has been affected by gun violence.
These kids even tell me, like, yeah, you know, somebody gets shot and then, you know, everybody's talking about it, woo-woo, for a couple days, and then it's back to normal, and then it happens again.
For them, the trauma is not post. Hadari says it's always happening now.
Hyper-awareness to the sounds in your neighborhood, to the people, to facial expressions. Your body has to be able to predict these situations before your mind is even developed enough to understand what that means. That hypervigilance is what's necessary.
Offering first aid skills could help community members feel less helpless, Hadari says, especially in parts of Chicago where there's no level 1 trauma center nearby. But for some people, teaching everyday citizens to be first responders feels like conceding that certain neighborhoods will never be safe. It feels like giving up.
Yeah, I can understand it. And I also think that it possibly comes from a more privileged place. And yeah, I mean, I realize there's going to be neighborhoods that maybe it's less the case, but, you know, maybe there's still some connection to it that would be valuable.
At the national level, advocates for the Stop the Bleed initiative say teaching first aid to control blood loss helps prepare the country for the next bombing or natural disaster, not just the next shooting. Homeland Security experts at the White House say it's just part of bystander education, like teaching CPR or making sure one of those defibrillators is nearby to jumpstart someone's heart. At the community training in Philadelphia, everyone's talking, but emergency medicine doctor Tim Bryan's voice is the loudest.
Good. Everybody ready?
He's a Navy veteran, and you can tell he's used to giving commands.
All y'all know what you're doing? You know what you're doing, ma'am?
Bryan designed the program based on his experience as a combat medic. At the end of the evening, he stages a mini-drama to test the group. One person needs to be the casualty. Someone else will wrap the bandages and place the tourniquet.
We got a volunteer shooter, too.
2 other people will lift and carry the victim. Bryan tells one woman to hold back the crowd and clear the way for the police.
All right, so remember, hey, you could ask somebody, hey, help me control the scene, right? Who called 911? Ready? Bam! Down you go.
Those are the sounds of a mock shooting and pretend witnesses rushing in to help. Tanya English reported on the efforts to teach first aid skills to bystanders of gun violence.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and today we're talking about different interventions. Last week, I was at a park in Philadelphia, and there was a homeless guy walking around. He was very agitated. He was screaming at somebody who wasn't there. He was in his 50s, dressed in rags, and he was carrying all of his stuff in plastic bags. He made me think of a young man I met recently.
My name is Oberon Wackwitz. I'm 20 years old.
Oberon is mild-mannered, friendly, with a boyish face and an easy smile. He's a sharp dresser, so why would I think of him after seeing the guy in the park? They do have something in common.
I was kind of hearing these voices that were, you know, coming from my head, and I knew they were in my head, but I, you know, they were very loud, very...
This started happening during Oberon's first year in college. He was terrified, ashamed. He was responding to the voices, but hiding that as much as possible.
You know, my brother would walk in and, you know, be like, what are you doing? And I'm like, oh, I'm like rehearsing for something, or, you know, nothing. You know, I'm just like speaking out loud or something. You know, I'm thinking out loud or whatever.
Psychosis can begin as a blurring of lines between what's real and what's imagined, says psychiatrist Irene Herford.
Maybe it's harder to tell if people are looking at you, or is that in your head, or did I hear that, or was that my imagination, or what, did I see something in the corner of my eye or not?
The voices in Oberon Wackwitz's head grew louder and more demanding. They told him to cut himself, that he was worth nothing. Eventually, things got so bad he checked himself into a psych hospital. It was not the caring environment he had expected.
It felt like being in a prison, really. It did. They take your phone. You can't use your cell phone. You have this one phone that you can use to contact people with. They take your belongings. They, you know, give you, like, hospital clothes. I mean, sometimes if you, you know, bring clothes over, you can wear things, but you can't wear belts and stuff.
He was also frightened by the other patients he saw there. They were mostly older, years into serious mental illness, talking to themselves, shuffling along. He thought, this is going to be me. When he met a girl his own age, another patient, he was excited, but it didn't last long.
She's like, oh yeah, the people here, they're kind of like crazy, right? And I'm like, yeah, we're just talking. And then she says, you know, my sister, you know, she was in the Illuminati and, you know, these bats flew out of her. And I'm like, you know, okay.
He says the week-long hospital stay did help him because he might have died by suicide without it. But overall, it was a scary experience. And this is how many people with psychosis are introduced to the mental health field.
And then when he's discharged and says to himself, I'm never going back there, we talk about him being non-compliant as though it's his fault.
Irene Herford runs a Philadelphia early intervention program called PEACE, Psychosis Education, Assessment, Care, and Empowerment. It's a 2-year intensive outpatient program where Oberon is now receiving care, talk therapy, music and art groups, family therapy, medication, everything under one roof. He's back in college and doing well. Mental health providers around the country are trying to achieve this kind of success story, to get people help before their lives are derailed. Psychosis is associated with some of the most serious mental illnesses, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder. It only affects a small portion of the population, but Herford says the impact is severe.
Psychosis is bad for the brain. Like, the longer you're psychotic, the worse things are for you in the long run.
Hospitalizations, no education or employment, homelessness, that's what we're talking about. Roughly 4 million young Americans suffer from a severe mental illness, and research finds less than half receive the necessary treatment. The PEACE program is for Medicaid recipients. People are referred by hospitals, sometimes by family members, social workers, and the main goal is to keep young people on track.
Our expectation of people in our program is that they get back into the community and live their lives. So it's not just a goal, it's truly an expectation that people go to school or go to work, because these are young people at the very beginning of their lives, and it is not okay to drop out.
PEACE is still fairly new. It's just over a year old, but it's modeled on older early intervention programs around the country. Oregon started to run early interventions in 2001. Tamara Sales of Portland State University oversees the now statewide network, which has drastically reduced hospitalizations for clients and kept them in school and employed.
The majority of people are choosing not to go on disability.
This is a big deal. Remember, we're talking about people in their late teens, early 20s, a time when you decide what you'll be as an adult.
To go on disability at that point can be a really major long-term determinant of what their life course is.
Research on programs like this here and abroad has found similar results. Less illness, better outcomes. The World Health Organization declared that the duration of untreated psychosis should be 3 months or less. Here's Irene Herford again.
Our average duration of untreated psychosis in the U.S. is 1 to 3 years. So we're really far off the mark.
She spends a lot of her time educating people about the early warning signs of psychosis and trying to diminish the massive stigma that surrounds it. Oberon Wackwitz says getting enrolled with the Peace Program has given him a lot of courage to talk about his condition. He says without the program, he might not be here. He might have heeded the voices that told him to end it all. This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. We're taking a look at interventions today, and much of the public health conversation has been about lead in recent weeks, fueled, of course, by the water crisis in Flint, Michigan. Flint was the site of the Democratic debate between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders last weekend, and one of the few things they could agree on was that what happened in Flint was disastrous and that it could happen elsewhere in the country.
We need to rebuild our crumbling infrastructure, our water systems, our wastewater plants, our roads, and our bridges.
I support 100% the efforts by your senators and members of Congress to get the money from the federal government in order to begin the work that must occur to fix the infrastructure.
Rebuilding a lead-free infrastructure could be a way bigger task than anticipated because this current public enemy number one was once considered a desirable plumbing material. Keystone Crossroads' Irina Zhorov reports.
Down the street from our studio on the south side of Pittsburgh is Vogue True Value Hardware.
You sell plumbing equipment here?
Sure do. What are you looking for?
That's Sean Vogue, the store's owner. I asked him if I could buy some lead piping for my house.
No.
Why not?
It's no longer legal. That's like an old-fashioned thing.
He actually looked slightly horrified that I'd requested lead.
The EPA, you know, monitors the city, and they actually did a run through here probably within the past year, checking all the hardware stores to make sure that there isn't, you know, anything on the shelves anywhere. We didn't have any, you know. I think it's pretty common sense that you don't want lead in your drinking water.
That wasn't always so.
From a purely engineering perspective, lead had attractive features. It was durable and it was malleable. My name is Werner Truskin. I'm a professor of economics at the University of Pittsburgh.
Truskin wrote a book called The Great Lead Water Pipe Disaster.
If you go back and you read the engineering journals from, say, 1900, you find lots of quotations from engineers saying, look, lead's going to last a really long time. This is really the Cadillac of pipes. We want to use it.
And it's true. Lead does last a really long time. In many cases, pipes installed 100 years ago are doing just fine. At the same time, the health effects of lead were minimized. In the 1800s and early 1900s, some doctors linked miscarriages and various health issues to lead poisoning from pipes. But the lead problem was slow-moving. And besides, says Truskin, public health officials had bigger fish to fry.
Compare that to, say, if somebody says cholera is a problem or typhoid's a problem. Cholera can kill you in 48 hours.
In Pennsylvania, at the turn of the 20th century, officials did start to accept that lead wasn't all good. The industry fought back. Richard Rabin, a public health professional who's written about lead, says the industry prolonged its product's reign by lobbying.
They sent some of their staff around the country.
They met with plumbing associations, plumbing code writers, and local, state, and federal government officials.
To urge them to keep using lead pipes. In some cases where lead pipes were banned, they were able to get those bans overturned.
Philadelphia already required lead lines in the early 1900s. According to the Lead Industries Association's meeting minutes from 1938, they successfully pushed codes requiring lead for plumbing in the rest of Pennsylvania that year. At a training center for plumbers outside Pittsburgh, Tom Bigley walks past a 2x4 skeleton of a house where students practice various plumbing skills. One wall is lined with toilets and see-through pipes.
You can see that's what happens when you flush your toilet. It gives you a very good visual on how a plumbing system works.
At another workstation, he picks up a sawed-off chunk of lead waterline. It's got a bulge where it connects to a valve.
This is actually called a lead wipe joint. They don't do that anymore, but that was part of the trade back. That's why a plumber, that's where they got their name from. That's a Latin word for lead, lead wiper.
Bigley started out in 1980, but he never learned how to make those joints. By then, lead was a little passé. Copper became the material of choice. Then, plastic. Plus, officials finally accepted the negative health effects of lead exposure. Local and federal agencies banned lead by 1986. But many lead lines remain, and Bigley's never really thought it was a problem. While Flint's experience is giving him pause, Bigley and a fellow plumber, John Inks, say the call to replace all lead lines is complicated and expensive.
We're going crazy over this lead thing. Where's it going to stop, though? Is it going to stop at the lead service lines? Is it going to go into like, oh, okay, that was leaded copper back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, part of the 80s? Where's it going to stop? I don't know. I mean, that's a lot. You're talking a lot of infrastructure.
Because even the houses that have copper, they use 50-50 solder. So right. Now you have the solder joints have lead in them.
Right.
So where's it going to end is right.
They're not against the idea of tackling all that infrastructure. They just seem overwhelmed by the thought of it. And the hardest part? Lead's everywhere, but no one knows where exactly. It's not mapped, not documented. Pittsburgh, for one, is planning to try and identify where the lead lines are. And cities around the country are thinking about what it would take to replace them. For The Pulse, I'm Irina Zhurov.
Digging up all the lead service lines in America is a project of such massive scale, it's hard to wrap your head around it. Millions of pipes, billions of dollars, don't even think about the timeline on this thing. But that didn't stop a group of volunteers from rolling up their sleeves and getting their hands dirty, literally. We're talking about plumbers who donated a weekend to helping the people of Flint get the lead out of their homes. Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton brings us this story.
Since October, plumbers with United Association Local 370 in Flint have been volunteering to install filters and faucets to get lead out of people's tap water. Last month, on a cold Saturday, the local guys got some help from a small army of more than 300 plumbers driving in from cities across Michigan. They get a rousing Union Pride welcome from Local 370 official Harold Harrington.
We did not cause this American tragedy in Flint, but we certainly can help correct the damage that has been done.
Everyone is paired up and given instructions and a list of addresses. I'm with Jordan Belil and his cousin Tyler. They get their list, grab armloads of donated faucets, filters, and test kits, and head out. Our first stop is the home of Bertie Johnson.
This is a blessing. I really appreciate it.
Like practically every house in Flint, she has cases of bottled water stacked in the kitchen. Johnson says, in a way, it was lucky her water didn't look right 2 years ago. That was when the city switched from Detroit water to Flint River water in order to save money.
I was buying the water before we even realized that they said all the lead was in it because the water was brown, looked like Kool-Aid.
Jordan Belil finds out Johnson needs a specific kind of faucet that he doesn't have. She'll be put on a list for a follow-up visit. In the meantime, he installs a filter in the laundry room.
But how that light's blinking green?
Mm-hmm.
That tells you that your cartridge is good.
Okay.
It would turn yellow when it's telling you it's getting close to being used up, and would blink red when it's time to change it.
Oh, okay.
Belil reminds Johnson to get her water tested. The next stop is the home of Lois Driscoll.
Hi there.
Hello.
Hi there.
This time the faucet replacement is successful. Driscoll laughs. They're replacing a brand new custom faucet with one exactly like the one she just got rid of. Then she turns serious. She and her family only stopped drinking the water 3 months ago.
We think that if we've been in drinking this water for a couple of years, and that's how long it has existed, that these efforts at this point, you know, it's the damage is almost done.
That may or may not be true for her family. Recent tests appear to show the water in many homes is under the federal action level for lead. But a few homes have so much lead that filters may not work. The plumbers visit 1,100 homes by the end of the day. Local 370 will keep on volunteering. Money, too, is starting to come in, including $58 million from the state of Michigan. Officials with the agencies responsible for causing the problem in the first place now say they're here for the long haul and will not abandon Flint until everything possible has been done to repair the damage. For The Pulse, I'm Tracy Samilton.
It's The Pulse. We're talking about interventions today, and intervening to get lead out of our water supply sounds like a nightmare. But what about people who've already been exposed to this substance? How do you get it out of their system? Meet the Degenhardt family.
I'm Mary Ann. I'm Joseph's mom.
I'm Joseph. I'm Joseph's dad.
And I'm Joseph, the son.
In their case, water wasn't the culprit, it was paint. In 2003, they bought an old house in New Jersey. The house was built in the 1920s, and they knew there was a lot of lead paint in there, so they tried to strip that away, and they were really careful not to leave any paint chips around where Joseph could get to them.
So our son Joseph was, he was
less
born
than
in...
Less than a year old, and I dropped a binky on a piece of lead, and I picked it up, and then I put it back into my mouth, which got me started into this lead poisoning thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would say that was probably, Joseph loved his binky, and dropping it and putting it back in was kind of a normal occurrence, but, you know, there was lead dust around that we really just were not aware of. So when it came time for Joseph's one-year wellness visit, we just went in for the blood work. I had a script for it, and we didn't think much more of it until probably a week later. I got a call from the doctor who was kind of on call on a Friday saying there was a really high lead reading with when Joseph's blood work came back, so he thought it was a mistake. So he wanted us to go ahead and get another reading. And we went back to the doctors, and the next day I remember it was the Collingswood Book Festival. I remember we got the call while we were kind of on pins and needles waiting, sitting at the book festival, trying to act like life was normal right now. And we got the call, and the doctor said, you need to get to the hospital immediately because that first reading was accurate, and we need to get working on treating that lead.
So for almost 2 weeks, I had to stay into the hospital getting all needles and all stuff that I wouldn't like, that I wouldn't usually enjoy.
And you didn't enjoy it.
No, I didn't enjoy it.
Yeah, it actually was on his, he spent his one-year birthday in the hospital. And I remember, though, it was kind of funny because he was on IV, actually, but he was feeling okay. So, you know, he would be, like, running down the halls and playing, really, and kind of acting like any one-year-old might, actually, except that he had an IV pole trailing behind. But we made the best of it. And I remember one of those nights in the hospital, just going down to the, there's a chapel in the hospital, and just kind of like crying my eyes out, thinking, how could we have let this happen? You know, it was really devastating. Yeah, it was a really tough time.
You were a big hit in the hospital with your very very brave and bold walking around with, I mean, you were like, you own the hospital. Like, you would walk down the hall pulling this 6-foot pole on wheels, and people got a big kick out of you. People really liked you.
Mm-hmm. I could picture myself.
The treatment was like right into the thighs, big needles right into the thighs in the hospital. Mm-hmm. But then when it went to intravenous after a few days with this chelation medicine, mm-hmm. something that actually binds to the lead and then it gets removed to his urine.
And then once we got home, then he had to go for regular blood work. And
yeah, I think it was every month or so. Yeah. So I had to do that for about 4 years. I had to go every day a month for 4 years, which added up to 48 visits in total, which I absolutely hated. It sort of felt unfair to me since mm-hmm. I had a brother who didn't have to go. After that, so after I think my last visit, I was scared that I would have to get another test, but mm-hmm. that never happened. And I suddenly got happy. Yeah.
We did have a early intervention, I don't know what you call it, a caseworker come out, and that's if a child is not developing at the, you know, the level where they're supposed to be. So they came out and did an evaluation and did find that Joseph was maybe like 3 months or so behind where they thought he should have been. They came out and basically played with him 2 or 3 times a week for an hour or so. And then we also had a speech therapist come out. And after, I'm going to say a year, Joseph was right up to par where he needed to be.
Mary Ann Degenhart, her husband Joseph, and their son Joseph, who is now 13 years old. This story was produced by Paige Flager. This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about interventions today, and here's something that I think will delight a lot of parents. When kids get sick at school, it can be a big disruption. They have to miss class, and their mom or dad has to leave work and come get them. So what if kids could see a pediatrician without having to leave school? Lauren Silverman reports on a tech solution being tried out in the Lone Star State.
While most second graders at Gilbert Elementary are sitting at lunch tables, sticking hot slices of cheese pizza in their mouths, Diego Montealvo is standing in the nurse's office, opening wide for a cold piece of metal.
Way out. All right, perfect.
That voice isn't the school nurse. It's a doctor. And the doctor isn't in this room in Irving. She's at an office building in Dallas. But she's looking at Diego, her face on a big screen on top of a rolling cart. Like a conductor, she's directing the school nurse to examine Diego with digital instruments. Now, for a look inside his nose.
I get to see your boogies up close. Do you have boogies?
He smiles shyly as a close-up of the hairs in his nose and a few boogies pop up on the screen. Diego isn't sick today, but when he came in to see the school nurse last November, he had an ear infection. At this point, mom or dad usually has to leave work to pick up the kid, call the doctor to try and find time for an appointment, maybe visit an urgent care center or the ER. The kid misses school, the parent misses work. With telemedicine, Diego can now connect remotely to a doctor at Children's Health during school. Back in November, a doctor saw him between classes, diagnosed him with an ear infection, and prescribed an antibiotic. His mom, Isabel Montealvo, said that saved her time and money.
So whenever, after I left work, all I had to do was go pick up the prescription from the pharmacy because they sent it over.
Children's started this program at a few preschools in 2013. Today, it's in 57 urban and rural campuses across North Texas. It's one of the largest school-based telemedicine programs for kids in the country. Dr. Stormy Williams, she's the one who was peering into Diego's throat and nose, explains each school is selected based on need.
We look at
kind of a map of where kids are going to the ER for non-emergent issues. And where can we step in to kind of fill that gap for the families and for the kids?
The number of children who are uninsured in Texas is high, 1 out of 9. For these kids, William says it's not easy to see a doctor for pink eye, the flu, or a stomach ache. And that's where this program aims to help. Of course, not everything can be diagnosed via telemedicine. Rashes, she admits, can be tricky.
Because sometimes I can look at a rash from, you know, across the room and say, that's a ringworm. Other times I need to feel it, see what it feels like, see the borders of it, things like that. So we will send them to their primary care doctor.
Research shows parents can save time and money with school-based telemedicine. The focus now is on whether telemedicine is improving kids' health. Only a few studies have been done so far, but it looks promising. For example, a study in the journal Pediatrics found that kids with type 1 diabetes who used telemedicine at school had better blood sugar control and fewer visits to the ER. Dr. Kianta Moore, a health policy researcher at Rice University, points to research showing telemedicine visits were similar in quality and outcomes as face-to-face encounters. And in some cases, kids preferred digital encounters.
Because they were more comfortable with that web-based communication, kind of now how our adolescents communicate with one another. They can be in the same room and texting and Facebooking each other. In that one study, it showed that, hey, adolescents actually prefer to engage in these telepsychiatry visits rather than the in-person consultations.
The challenge with school-based telemedicine, Moore says, isn't technology. It's cost effectiveness. There's the cost of equipment, which can be tens of thousands of dollars, and the risk of not getting reimbursed by insurers. Although Children's isn't billing patients directly at this point, they plan to in the future. The hospital has shared best practices with Arkansas Children's Hospital and the University of Texas Medical Branch. In the meantime, dozens of schools across the country are experimenting with telemedicine, from Kansas to Arizona and Georgia. Most are collecting data to see if the programs help kids like Diego miss fewer days of school and parents save money.
Do you have any questions, Diego?
No.
Do you want to see inside your nose again?
No.
For The Pulse, I'm Lauren Silverman.
Lauren Silverman is a reporter for KERA in Texas. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Hospital visits can provide a small window of opportunity to help a person who is a victim of human trafficking. Marketplace healthcare reporter Dan Gorenstein is here now. He's just completed a 3-part series on trafficking and how medical providers can help. Let's take a listen to an excerpt from his first story where a physician is faced with a mystery.
I run into this weird triage note on the board, and this one said, I have a tracker in me.
It's October 2015. Dr. A, we're not using his name or identifying his hospital to protect patient safety, is 28 years old and about as green as they come. And he's got a patient who claims she's got a GPS tracking device implanted in her side.
When you work on the east side of our hospital, psychiatric patients are a dime a dozen.
But this patient is different. She's put together, she's lucid, and she's got an incision. The doctor orders an x-ray. Dr. A says everybody crowds around the computer.
Embedded in the right side of her flank is a small metallic object, only a little bit larger than a grain of rice. But it's there. It's unequivocally there. She has the tracker in her. No one was speaking for... it had to be at least 5 seconds. And in an ER, in a busy ER, that's saying something.
Dan Gorenstein, were these doctors able to help this patient?
Yes, they were able to help this patient. They were able to pull out what ultimately, Mike, was an RFID chip that had been implanted in her. This is technology that's very commonly used in cats and dogs, pets. They were able to get it out. And it was really interesting to note, I think it was that Dr. A's impression that this patient, a woman in her 20s, was so despondent. She'd been so controlled that she showed almost no emotion the entire episode, except when he finally extracted this grain of rice-sized RFID chip. And he sort of, it felt kind of like a relief.
We're also joined by Hani Soklosa. She is a physician and the co-director of the advocacy organization Heal Trafficking. Hani, what do providers need to have in place to help patients, to connect them to resources?
Well, the first step is awareness of the problem. In many hospitals and clinics, this is just not on clinicians' radars at all. We know about domestic violence, about child abuse, but this is not a standard part of our curriculum. And after that, really the next steps are for hospitals and clinics across the country to have plans in place so that it's not just kind of by random chance that someone's screened for trafficking and connected to resources.
And Dan, as you were investigating this, what did you find out about the scope of the issue?
So it's really not well known. I mean, there's some figures. It seems like a lot of people use a global number of 20.9 million people are being trafficked. That's both labor trafficking and sex trafficking. But the reality is, at least here in the U.S., there's not great data.
But we're talking mostly about American citizens who are being moved around against their will.
That's right. And I think the Justice Department has found that 83% of confirmed sex trafficked victims are, in fact, U.S. citizens.
What should physicians ask when they suspect a person is being trafficked? They already ask, do you feel safe at home for domestic violence? So what should they ask?
In many ways, it's not just the questions that we're asking. It's more important to be in the moment, to be caring, to establish that trust and rapport with the patient. And, I now ask all of my patients that I know are dealing with substance abuse, how do you pay for your drugs? A lot of them then tell me, you know, I'm selling my body for drugs. For my patients that I'm worried about labor trafficking, so somebody that comes in with a weird injury that doesn't kind of correspond with what they're telling me in terms of a story, one of the things I'll ask them is, you know, if I give you a couple of days off from work with this work note, will you be able to take off from work? And just seeing their reaction in response to that is really, really telling.
I think something that Hani told me a long time ago when I first started reporting this, Mike, and that was really compelling to me is, you know, she goes around and she does these trainings. And she'll sort of talk about and describe what human trafficking is. She'll give a definition. And she says when she's in a room of doctors and nurses, there's often a gasp, an audible gasp, because so many providers realize, oh, my goodness, I've treated these people.
Dan and Hani, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Hani Soklosa is a physician and the co-director of Heal Trafficking, a human trafficking education and advocacy organization. She's based out of Harvard Medical School. Dan Gorenstein is a Marketplace senior reporter, and he focuses on the business of healthcare. Listening to The Pulse, I'm Mike and Scott, and our show today is about interventions. In healthcare, raising awareness is big, right? Think about all of the different walks and the ribbons, the colors associated with different conditions. The thinking is, if you are in the know about symptoms and prevention, you'll make better health decisions. But a lot of people still don't know the warning signs of a disease that kills 1 in 4 women nationwide, heart disease. For most of her life, 82-year-old Mary Lou Stresnevsky never thought about this issue. She was always unshakably healthy. She taught high school English in Pennsylvania for nearly 3 decades. She's also a writer and a poet. In December of 2006, she had a heart attack. She says there were many red flags leading up to this, but she didn't recognize them, and neither did her physicians. She had to have triple bypass and several valves replaced, and she described her experience and how writing helped her recovery for our series, Patient Files.
The story began at midnight in my bathroom when I couldn't breathe. I really could not breathe. It's a very, very weird feeling when you go to take a breath and there's nothing there. They were calling this a salvage surgery, which I just loved. The symptoms can be in very strange areas of your body. Vomiting, upper back pain, bad case of indigestion. I didn't know that. Men don't generally have these symptoms. They do the classic pain down the arm, crushing feeling in the chest. So the combination for me was the flu-like symptoms, the fatigue, and the throat pain. The operation was 7 hours, and I was in the hospital for 8 days. Anxiety and depression come with the territory. One of the weird things is the inability to accept good news. The doctor says, you know, you're doing fine. And it's like, yeah, but what's she not telling me? The depression can come and go. It's chemical. It's body chemistry adjusting itself. And I developed a little mantra for myself. You know, when you wake up some morning and you feel like totally flat, you don't want to get out of the bed. My little mantra was, it's chemical and it will pass. And it always did. It's chemical and it will pass. And it always did. I am a poet. I have 3 poetry books out. But trauma affects the language area of your brain. And all my friends, you know, kept saying, oh, you have so much to write about. And I thought, I don't want to write about this. And it was 6 months before I put pen to paper, before I wrote anything at all. Here's about waking. The lowest third of our brains we have in common with, among other beings, snakes. The prefrontal cortex makes decisions, but it lay in anesthesia's sleep. The limbic system. This poem is called The Decider, and it is my take on what was probably happening to me during the crucial moment of the surgery. The poems alternate with the surgeon's notes. When they cut me loose from the surgeon's magic pump, my heart refused to start. The patient was separated from the bypass with some difficulty. The patient was placed back on the pump. Once, twice, they tried. The surgeons, they admitted later, cheering, come on, girl, you can do it. Did not sleep. Third try, it caught. Some say no anesthetic can make you deaf. Did I hear them call me back? After additional rest time on the pump, the patient was then separated from the bypass with an ejection fraction of 35 to 40 at least. In that space, who decided I would live? 6 months, the question sang, waking, dreaming. Then I understood. The ancient reptile that lives in the bottom of the skull did not sleep. Eyeless, it observed. Earless, it listened. Voiceless, it whispered, survive, survive, survive. I realized fairly early on that the doctors can repair you, rebuild your heart, but they can't heal you. That's your job.
Mary Lou Strefsnevsky has written a memoir called Heartrending, Heartmending, Saved by Medical Science, Healed by Ancient Wisdom. We have more of her poetry on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Alana Gordon produced this story. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Libby Tracy is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Paige Flager, the associate producer. Joel Patterson is our managing editor. And Megan Pinto, the executive producer. Next week, The Pulse is all about making a match. We're not going to get ourselves up on Tinder, but we're going to talk about stuff like finding the perfect music for your workout and much more. Don't miss that show. Subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.